Our guest is Jack Cashel. We're going to take your phone calls as we're talking about the anniversary of the downing of flight TWA Flight 800. Different theories abound, of course. The official theory is that there was an explosion of flammable fuel vapors in the center fuel tank with an arcing short circuit of a wire. And, of course, we've heard others, subjects, as you just heard Jack talking about how a Navy missile test that went awry may have taken it down, too. We've got some questions for him and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with Jack Cashel and your calls, of course. Jack, a former United States Air Force veteran, sent us an email, and he wanted to know why they didn't designate a temporary no-fly zone in that area.
You know, I wish I could answer that question. You know, I'm thinking, you know, and trying to deduce the logic of it from the information we have, it seems like what they had been doing was upping the difficulty parameters of this exercise they had been doing. And now they're 2 days before the election, and they have threats of, you know, actually real threats of chartered planes filled with explosives flying into major targets. I think they figured that if they could not pull this exercise off in a crowded airspace, why even bother doing it? The problem came when TWA 800 was held down to 13,000 feet instead of ascending to 18,000 feet because, as it was supposed to, because another plane was crossing overhead. I think it just wandered in. It was a terrible error. I mean,
it was just a tragedy of all kinds of mistakes, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Bad timing.
And, you know, as we saw in the Vincennes incident when they shot down the Iranian Airbus, killing 290 people. It's complicated, these Aegis missile systems, and they're maybe too complicated for people who are not particularly well-trained, especially under stressful circumstances.
Did the missile work in that it did take down the plane, which was its intent?
Yes, it was its intent, and in that case, yes. But there was another case with a naval exercise which involved Turkey, in which we didn't shoot down a plane, but we accidentally fired a missile and killed something like 26 Turkish sailors.
Oh, my God.
So, accidents can happen. And in the Vincennes case, the young officer who was responsible for the firing mechanism made 23 mistaken that they reviewed this before it finally, another officer oversaw him and corrected him. He hit the wrong switch something like 23 consecutive times before they got it right. You know what I mean?
Go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, the analysis of that, you know, the serious analysis done was that it's extraordinarily complicated and it needs, they needed much better training than they had.
Do you know if the eyewitnesses who claim they saw a missile type going up still stick to that story?
Oh, totally. In fact, I'm having lunch with the key eyewitness on Saturday morning, which is the 25th anniversary of Mike Wire, the man on the bridge. Yeah, they never wavered. There's a lot of them have been very serious. Tom Stalkup and Christina Borges did an excellent documentary a few years ago. I think it's just called TWA Flight 800. And Stalkup is a physicist who's been working this essentially almost since it happened. And Christina Borges had worked for CBS News until she tried to break the story out. And she eventually got fired for trying to working with Sanders to try to get the foam rubber tested. And what she handed over to 60 Minutes, and they called the FBI on her. You know, so.
And this happened at 8:31 Eastern Time, daylight saving time, but it was getting kind of dark, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, but it's sunset. This is you've been to the beach. This is the beach area. There are thousands, literally thousands of people out there. The FBI interviewed 750 eyewitnesses.
Did they hear anything or just see something?
Well, they saw something, and they heard things, too. But 250 of those eyewitnesses saw the plane being destroyed. And 56, as I mentioned earlier, tracked the missile from the horizon to the plane. Many of them gave the FBI detailed drawings of what they saw.
The excuse I heard at the time was what they saw was not the missile going up. It was jet fuel coming down. Remember that one?
That was part of the CIA's, disinformation plot.
Yeah.
It doesn't hold. It doesn't begin to hold water against the seriousness and the credibility of the eyewitnesses. They know what they saw. They describe what they saw in perfect detail. One conversation I had in 2009, a woman calls me out of the blue, and she says, Jack, I'm witness 73. Do you know who I am? I said, yes, I do. I know your case exactly, because she was probably the best of all the eyewitnesses, because she was an aviation professional. She was on the beach. She was following the 747, and she said to her friends, boy, that plane's lower than it ought to be, you know, because she knew enough.
Yeah, she could tell.
And then she saw she independently tracked the missile. She followed the missile to the plane. She watched it arc over. She described it to the FBI as like an upside-down Nike swoosh, which is appropriate because it would have corrected to make that maneuver. And then she described the breakup sequence of the airplane in the exact detail that it was broken up. It would take the NTSB weeks to map out the debris field that justified her observation. So what she called me about was, and when we're talking, I said, you know, when the FBI came back to interview you the second time, you said you'd been drinking Long Island iced teas and you weren't really sure what you saw? She goes, that's what I wanted to talk to you about, Jack. She goes, I don't know what a Long Island iced tea is.
Oh, my
gosh. I said, well, might it have been another drink? She goes, no, because I don't drink at all. And she goes, finally, there was no second interview. She had just learned from another source that who had seen the CIA documents that she had been interviewed twice. She had only been interviewed the one time. They fully fabricated a second interview with her. And she was, as I told her, you're not alone. She was at least one of three key eyewitnesses, including the fellow I'm having lunch with Saturday, for whom they fabricated a total new second interview. So it would better fit the CIA scenario. It's outrageous what they got away with. And this is all documented. They brag about it almost. In fact, the guy who was responsible, their head analyst, got a medal for it.
Let's go to some calls for you. Mary in Fargo, North Dakota, to get us started. Welcome to the show. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
That was the night I couldn't sleep. And Art Bell, you ought to look up the files, because all of the calls that came in were from people all along Long Island who had watched that happen. Some of them were retired military and knew what the kind of missile was, and others were people who didn't know anything about that.
No, you're right, and because there were, I mean, it was a beautiful night. It was, you know, 71 degrees. It was the kind of night everyone's on the beach. And there was that video that came out that night, and before it was suppressed, lots of people saw that. And, Mary, I had George One, my very good eyewitness I had to this, was a fellow who at the time of the crash he was a 747 pilot for a cargo plane. He had used to work for Boeing and missile testing. He was laid up in a Hong Kong hospital with back surgery. His wife was there visiting him, and Hong Kong didn't pull the video. They continued. He said, I saw it 50 times.
Jeez. Were there any pilots from other planes who might have seen something?
Yes, there were several pilots, and they were the ones who called it in at first, right, immediately. And most of them saw it from above, so they weren't in a position to see an ascending missile, but
okay.
They saw was a high explosive. It wasn't the fuel tank explosion that the NTSB eventually settled on. These were bright white flashing lights from high explosives, not the soft effusive yellowish kind of light that comes from a billowing fuel tank explosion.
Let's go to Cornelius in Alexandria, Louisiana. Welcome to the program. Hi, Corny.
Hey, George. Hopefully I won't get clipped. Tommy told me that was an accident the other night. But, Jack, I'm glad you're on. George, I wanted to spotlight Newsmax, the Spicer & Company. They're doing a special on the FBI, and it'll rebroadcast from 4 a.m. Central Time to 5 a.m.
Yeah, they do a good job.
Yeah, about misconduct in the FBI and what they did with this NASA case about all those gymnasts and stuff. And now the gymnasts want the FBI to fire these agents that lied. But, Jack, I want to turn back to the normal subject. So do you think the FBI director ordered these FBI agents, or the CIA director ordered them to lie and stuff like that and cover this up? And I'll take
I think the FBI, other than the maybe the top guys, and I think they were under pressure. I think their instinct was to do the right thing. The agents, the individual agents, were inexperienced. They really didn't know what they were doing. The Suffolk County, you know, police had have a naval, I mean, have an you know, an aquatic unit, marine unit. You know, they were able to use positional guides and, you know, GPSs and stuff to track everything. The FBI guys just went out with their notebooks. But that said, they tried to do the right thing. They were overwhelmed by the powers that be and the CIA and coming out of the White House. This had to come out of
it. If the plane was 13,000 feet high when they got hit, how far away do you think the Navy ship was that had the missile launch?
I couldn't tell you exactly, probably within 20 or 30 miles. Curiously, the Vincennes, when it shot down that Airbus, the Airbus was at 13,000, you know, 800 feet, almost exactly the same
height
elevation. So it was not a hard shot.
But if you're 20 miles away, they might not even have known that they hit something.
No, that's exactly right. And especially if it was fired from a sub. You know, I talked to a lot of guys.
Well, that's true. That's possible.
Who I said, how many people would know? Well, if it was a cruiser, you know, a whole lot of people would know that something was fired. But I talked to a guy who was on a sub that was capable of doing this, and he said, you know, we would know that something was fired back that came out of the tube. We wouldn't know what it was or where it went or what it did. So they might not even registered. And then, as I said, with the USS Carr, where I do have a witness who came forward, they immediately hightailed it to Bermuda and wouldn't let anyone off the ship or let them talk to anyone, make phone calls home or anything. So there was a real shutdown of information immediately on that case. And I would like to get, you know, what I'd really like to get out of the show, George, and anyone who's interested could contact me through my website at cashel.com. At this stage, the only way we're going to break this case is if someone who is high up in that chain of command
goes public. Yeah, absolutely. And so far, it's been 25 years. They haven't.
Not anyone high up. You know, I've had lots of help from people, you know, like the people who were at the air traffic control center that night, from people who were on one of the subs that loaded, experimental new missiles onto it, but wasn't on the ship that night, the boat that night. I mean, so there's all these peripheral people who've come forward, let alone all the mechanics, they have Boeing engineers, et cetera. I literally talked to hundreds of people with some degree of knowledge, and as useful as that knowledge has been, is, you know, to this point, from now on, the only people they're going to be able to get through are people who know something very specifically.
Absolutely. Let's go to Helena in South Orange, New Jersey. Welcome to the program. Hi, Helena.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I don't know if thank you is the correct word under circumstances.
Understand.
As I explained to your call screener, I was scheduled to leave for Israel on July 17, 25 years ago.
Oh,
I had a ticket for the Israel airline. And when I got to the airport at Kennedy, they told me that the airline had overbooked and offered me $500 if I would change my ticket to a TWA flight that made a stopover in Paris.
Oh, my gosh. You would have been on that plane.
I was about to accept, and all of a sudden,
my God,
I visualized an incident that occurred several years before when I was flying to Israel on a TWA flight that was absolutely horrendous, including a bomb scare. And I declined the ticket, the money,
mm-hmm.
and I said, thank you, but no thank you, I'll keep my ticket. That night was a very restless night.
Hold on, Jack.
As if I knew something was going to happen. And the next day when I arrived in Israel, the airport was, everybody was crazy talking about the flight that had crashed or gone down.
Yeah.
And on my way to my destination, on the radio they announced it was a TWA 800 that gone down.
Gosh. God was with you that night, Helena.
Well, you know, just
amen.
To validate that, Helena, there was an LL plane in the queue that night that for whatever reason, the TWA 800 replaced in the queue. So some people think that it was some sort of conspiracy to take down the LL plane. Actually, you know, I looked into that. It just seemed to be one of those unfortunate or fortunate coincidences, depending on what plane you're on. But, yeah, it could have been you. You're lucky.
Ramzi Youssef is still alive in a Colorado state federal prison. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was one of the masterminds of 9/11,
right,
is still at Guantanamo Bay. Wouldn't you love to interview those two?
If they're willing to tell the truth, certainly. You know, I drove by that Florence, Colorado Supermax last year. It's an amazing place. It's like prison city. You know, it's just amazing.
He's got to be isolated, or they.
Well, you know,
get
it's because he's in that same prison are people like Terry Nichols, you know,
and
it's a strange mix of people who end up in that place, and I'm not sure you really want them. I don't know if they're out in the general population or what, but
he can't be. Some of those prisoners would take care of him. You know the way that happens.
Yeah.
My gosh, let's take another call before the break. Let's go to Tom in Port Angeles, Washington. Welcome to the show. Hey, Tom.
Hello, George. Hello, George. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
What the thing that I needed to know on this subject was how much fuel had burned off of the center tank.
Do we know that, Jack?
We know there was. I mean, they were flying to Paris, which they didn't need that much fuel, so the center fuel tank was all but empty, except for just some residual fuel sloshing around the bottom.
Jack, let's give out your website again.
Yeah, just cashill.com, CASHILL.com. I beat my family to it about 25 years ago, and they're still upset with me.
The Navy missile launch, was it supposed to hit a dummy plane or something like that?
Well, you know, what we do know, we have a very good reason to believe, since an amateur photo was accidentally taken of a drone heading towards that very area. And the missile test, they historically use a drone as the enemy combatant.
Right.
Combatant. I believe that they were the drone. It's a famous photo. The New York Times ran the photo. No one could deny what it was. It was it's called the Cabot photo, KABOT.
And that's what the missile was supposed to hit.
Yeah. Yeah. Most likely. Yeah.
Now, what happened to the drone?
That's a good question. Pieces of the drone. I go into the book, and it's kind of a long, complicated story, but pieces of the drone wash up, and it's kind of involved. It's too long to get into, George, but it was destroyed, I think, somewhere, somehow along the way.
This is a passion for you still, Jack, isn't it? I can tell.
Well, you know, it's what happens is I don't deal with this every day, to say the least, but just picking up my book today and reading through it, it reminds me of what an open and shut case this is. There is no, it's like Occam's razor is the simplest explanation is the best. And the simplest explanation in the original Latin means that the simplest explanation accounts for all the relevant variables. All the relevant variables are accounted for in the theory that I've been advancing. There's no loose ends. There's nothing that can't be explained away. On the other hand, the NTSB has to explain away 20, 30, 40 things that make no sense given their theory. This is the self-destructing, exploding fuel tank. The first and only time in the history of 747, no one was grounded afterwards. The Air Force One is a 747, and that wasn't grounded. They don't believe this theory, but they were somehow forced or felt compelled to advance it, and I guess they have to live with it once they did it.
It's true. We're going to come back and take final calls with you, Jack, in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we're going live to England to talk about some urban myths with Charles Christian, a new time guest here on Coast to Coast. So I'm looking forward to that. We're going to come back and take final calls in a moment with Jack Cashel. His website is his last name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. His most recent book, Barack Obama's Promised Land, if you want to take a look at that as well. And welcome back to Coast, back with our final segment with Jack Cashel as we're talking about Flight 800. As we have approaching on July 17th, the 25th anniversary of that plane crash that was at the time the third biggest plane crash in American history. I think it still is, Jack, isn't it?
I believe so. I don't believe there's been a bigger one since, not that I can recall offhand anyhow.
What keeps driving you on this story?
Well, because this is a major story. And one of the tragedies today is the corruption of the American media. If the New York Times decided they were going to start telling the truth, this would be a different country a month from now. This is too big a story to be left on the table untold, or not untold, mistold. Dramatically and purposely mistold. If they can get away with this, there's almost nothing they can't get away with. This isn't just like a random conspiracy theory. This is a tangible, provable, and arguably valid thesis that virtually everyone in the aviation community acknowledges to be true, and yet the official explanation is allowed to stand in places like USA Today or CNN or the National Geographic Channel or History Channel.
What kind of fallout do you think would be if the government merely admitted this was a test that was tragically gone awry?
Today, 25 years after the fact, it'd probably be out of the news cycle in a week.
And people would accept the apology.
Yeah, because the major media would just want to say, well, you know, it might trend on Twitter for a day. But unless the major media, it's really not so much a government scandal, because governments are inclined to do corrupt things. Our founding fathers knew that, which is why they built in so many checks and balances. This is a media scandal. The media are not supposed to accept such a falsified bit of information and accept it and roll over. And that's what the New York Times did. And the rest of the media yielded to the New York Times on this. That's the real scandal. The New York Times ran a headline on 5 weeks after the crash, prime evidence found that the explosive device exploded inside the cabin. And then they went to great extremes to even make their readers believe they never said that. And then when Pierre Salinger comes out in the month of November, when the cause of the crash still isn't known, they did four separate articles humiliating Pierre Salinger. And the rest of the would-be whistleblowers across America saw that and said, hey, if they could do that to a legendary press secretary like Salinger, a U.S. senator, what could they do to me? That was the shot across the bow of they helped keep a whole lot of people silent.
Do you think Jim Kellstrom from the FBI, who just recently passed away, as we mentioned, really knew the story?
No. When I talked to him in 2016, I was stunned by how ignorant he seemed. I was really stunned because I thought he would be the one guy with the, you know, because he's a patriot.
Right.
A Vietnam vet, Marine. I thought he'd be the one guy to come clean. And the FBI historically has not been conspiratorial in the way the say CIA is. But when I talked to him in 2016, I was really disappointed.
Let's go to the phones.
Knowledge base.
Alan in New Hampshire. Take it away, Alan. Thanks for calling.
George, if you check in the archives back when Art Bell was on the air, he interviewed Colonel Donaldson. He was in a Black Hawk helicopter. Him and his crew, they were using flare forward looking infrared, and they saw the ordnance come up and hit flight 800. It's actually in your archives, the interview with Colonel Donaldson. Your guests might find some interest if you could interview Colonel Donaldson.
Yeah, just to correct the record slightly, Colonel William Donaldson was the foremost challenger to the Navy. After the NTSB's theory, he died tragically of a brain tumor.
He's
been no more than about 50 years old. You're confusing him, though, with Major Fritz Meyer, who was the helicopter pilot, Vietnam vet, who, with his partner, his name was Bauer, I believe, watched it all unfold right in front of them. And Meyer was, he went public the first day, and then they silenced him. But he said, hey, listen, I was in Vietnam. I know what a high explosive looks like. This wasn't a fuel tank explosion. I saw bang, 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 bright white light, then the fuel tank explosion. He was a very powerful witness. And, he talked before the clampdown came, and then they forbade him from going public.
We've got Danny in Oklahoma. Welcome to the show, Danny. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks, George. George. I had a couple things just to kind of put out there. I guess number one, CSNBC that obtained this, maybe the more important video of the ones that we know of.
MSNBC.
Did they show this video to the public? And if not, why not? And then also, why would the military? We all understand why they have exercises. It's very important for national security, but I don't understand why they would be holding military exercise under a very heavily civilian airspace. And also, what direction? Obviously, the 747 was eastbound to Europe.
Correct.
This missile, could it have possibly been fired from a Russian sub? Because I was wondering, what direction did these witnesses see it come from the horizon? Was it coming from the eastern horizon, or?
Well, there was actually more than one missile, and one was heading west, and one was heading pretty much due up. I mean, were they like slightly eastern, as far as I could from the.
Did one just land in the ocean, Jack?
And why as to why they would do it? It just seemed to me reckless that they would do an exercise like this, and yet they must have had their motivation. I'm hard pressed to tell you what it is.
And I've never heard the Russian scenario. Have you?
No, I've heard like an Iranian sub. But the Russians had no interest in this. I mean, there was nothing for them to be gained.
Next up, let's go to Alona in Beverly Hills, California. First-time caller. Hi, Alona.
Hi, George. This is such an interesting subject. I just Googled it online, and there are photos of a gentleman named Frank Hildrup, chief technical advisor for the NTSB, speaking in front of the TWA Flight 800 fuselage.
Right.
Then it says, the wreckage, photographed July 6, 2021, will be destroyed before the July 17th anniversary of the crash.
Yeah.
Why are they doing that?
I would say to destroy all potential evidence of them ever being, just to put it to bed totally, bury it. There's no reason to do that. It seems unmotivated that they would time it to the 25th anniversary. And it's part of what I talked to George about earlier. This becomes history. Starting Saturday, it's history. It's no longer in the news because right now, many of the people who were involved are still alive and kicking.
That's right.
When they bury that evidence, they bury the case. It's all over.
Was there anybody of any notoriety on the plane?
I've heard there was like members of the Bin Laden family or this or that. There was one guy who was a... suspect, and the kind of you have a plane going to Paris from New York, you're always going to have a few characters, but no one on that plane deserved his or her own missile. It wasn't a hit.
And there were a lot of French people on the plane too, weren't there?
Yes, there were, and the French were much more vigilant. Their media were much more aggressive in trying to get at the truth.
And this literally helped destroy TWA, which ended up getting bought out by American Airlines about several years later.
TWA had been struggling, but this was the death knell.
Pablo's with us, Houston, Texas, east of the Rockies. Pablo, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm calling because I remember that night, and I was driving my car here in the Houston area, and there was a big orange fireball that came across from east to west. And I know what time it was because I was going to meet some friends. But later on, about 2 or 3 months later, my boss at work showed me a magazine article from Sky and Telescope.
Yeah.
That they were saying that it might have gotten hit by one of the pieces of that fireball. It was a real big orange fireball, like I said, that I saw. I've never seen anything that big and that bright.
Yeah, Jack, that was one of the possibilities. You remember that?
In fact, you're right. At the final hearing, the meteorite theory was given more credibility than the Navy misfire.
You're right. I mean, the odds of getting hit by a meteorite are astronomical, but it could happen, I guess.
Astronomical, right? I mean, you think someone would be embarrassed by that theory, but no, not Not when you're grasping at straws, when you're trying to find some plausible explanation as to why, for the first time in history and only time since, a plane with jet A fuel would self-combust.
Did they ground all 747-100s after this?
No.
No. Isn't that strange?
Yeah, including Air Force One, you know.
Well, that's a good point. And again,
after a while, they suggested some little fix or another, but everyone knew it was just BS.
Your theory for the cover-up basically is what?
Re-election. Mixed with, a legitimate national security reason to conceal it. Because if they are testing, let's say, a new and high-end anti-missile capability, they don't want that publicized, obviously. So I suspect that the real motive was to get Bill Clinton reelected, but the motive that those who were silenced were told was, listen, for the sake of national security, we cannot go public with what happened.
Let's go to Brian in Washington, and welcome to the show. Hi, Brian.
Hi, George. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
A lot of my questions have already been answered here, but my main one was, I was curious if Boeing took all the blame for this horrible tragedy, or did they, TWA, have any fault at all, maybe for lack of maintenance? And that's what I got.
No, that's a good question. Both of them were bought off. Boeing at that time was in the midst of a merger with McDonnell Douglas, I believe.
Yep, out of St. Louis.
Right, and they needed the DOJ approval for that merger. That was the quid for their quo, for just bearing up to it. TWA was, had to pay out a lot of money to a lot of people. I guess their insurance company probably covered it.
Wasn't TWA once owned by Howard Hughes?
Yeah, it was actually, I think, pretty much started by Howard Hughes, yeah.
A long, long time ago.
In fact, it was based out of Kansas City, which is where I live. And when I did my book TV presentation on my book, TWA 800, I did it at the lab, at the museum, the TWA museum. And my audience was all TWA veterans.
Yeah, they ended up moving to St. Louis, by the way. It became
hub. Right. They moved their headquarters to St. Louis. They kept the overhaul base in Kansas City.
Yeah.
But at that presentation, as I said to them, I would not insult you or dishonor the memory of your loved ones by spreading conspiracy theories here. And not a single person dissented to my theory, to my talk.
West of the Rockies, Richard's with us in Lompoc, California. Welcome to the show. Hey, Rich, go ahead.
Thank you. Listen, that was the first night I ever heard Art Bell. I turned on the radio after I saw it on the TV.
Yeah.
And I thought the radio was defective because I picked them up like in 18 different places on the dial. But anyhow, a couple of things. I remember from the original show with Art and the investigation that there was a reporter that he snuck in and he got a picture of a big crease on the side of the plane, which they say the missile like skidded along it before it blew up. And then also he went in and he took samples of the upholstery on there and had them analyzed. And they had PTX and RTX explosive on them. And they explained that a month later, saying that the plane had just happened to be in a dog training exercise in Denver.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. That's Jim Sanders. I assume he's talking about Jack.
Right. Sanders did was the guy went in and took the photo as part of his, because he had been, as discovery, and his the fact that he was arrested. As to the dog training exercise, that was, I mentioned this earlier, but that was, Calsham's most dishonest moment, to get out there and just lie, there's no other word for it, as to, I was the first one in the media to talk to the cop who did the dog training exercise, and I talked to him 5 years after the fact. And he was a black officer out of St. Louis, a St. Louis police officer, and they humiliated him. You know, they had to make him the fall guy and say, he spilled explosives all over the plane, he didn't know what he was doing. He wasn't happy about it.
No, and he was a good officer.
Right, and he was one of many people who were humiliated or degraded by this whole process. The people who work maintenance at TWA, who were responsible for the center fuel tanks, these were the people that I heard from that were most furious about the explanation they finally came up with, because it was an insult to them personally. And the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers refused to go along with the government explanation. They said it was an external explosion that unzipped the fuselage and caused, finally, the fuel tank to explode.
Your new book, Barack Obama's Promised Land, where do people get that?
And they can get that wherever they buy books. Amazon.com is a place we keep score nowadays, so I'd recommend they go there. And they could, you know, the my PWA 800 book is still available for sale as well.
Super. And you, so, and you take emails through your website?
Yes. And I would recommend, at this point, I'm looking, as I said, George, for people who really have first-hand information.
Okay.
Because I there's no more venue for me to, after Saturday, there's nothing else I could say to get any
public. Well, when you're ready to break more info, you know where you can come.
Okay, thanks a lot, George. It's been a pleasure to be on the show, and you do a great job.
Thanks. Jack Cashel, and who just will not give up as we talk about the very tragic anniversary of TWA Flight 800, July 17th, 1996, 25 years ago. Up next, we're going live to the United Kingdom. We're going to be talking about some scary things on Coast to Coast.